Hello, this is Owen Bennett-Jones, and thanks for downloading the interview from the BBC. And for full details on the whole range of audio for free download and podcast and our terms of use, you can go to bbcworldservice.com/podcast. But my guest today is a man who argues that crunching numbers, analysing the vast amounts of data now available, offers a new way of predicting the future. Human intuition, says Professor Ian Ayres, is giving way to raw computing power. I hope you enjoy listening. Professor Ian Ayres, thanks very much for talking to us on the interview.
Thank you for having me.
And you're a numbers man. You love numbers.
I'm kind of obsessed by them, yes.
Always have been?
I guess, especially since college.
Right, because it says in your book, you've done a book on number crunching, a life with numbers and passion really can mix.
That's right. I am a geek, but, you know, you can care deeply about policy issues and love, and but still want to put your passions to the test.
Yes, because a geek. So what you're reckoning that normally, the normal image of a numbers person is that they're not passionate.
I think so.
Is that fair? It's not fair.
Well, I think it's not fair. There are those of us that are passionate and those of us that are less passionate. But what's really important is that we're driven by trying to know what causes what. We want to know what works. And some other people that are passionate may just be comfortable with sticking to passionate beliefs without putting those intuitions to the test.
All right, yes. And it's a lovely time for you to be alive because there are numbers everywhere, more and more data for you to work with.
Yeah, the real revolution is this revolution in capturing and cheaply storing information. And so there are now many data sets that are larger than the U.S. Library of Congress.
Yeah, exactly. I think you better talk us through that. Now, I've never been to the Library of Congress, but I imagine that its stacks are fairly replete. It would take you quite a while to walk through it, no doubt.
It is humongously large, monstrously large. It has, computer terms, about 20 terabytes of data. And a terabyte is 1,000 gigabytes. A tera comes from the Greek word for monster. And so it's a lot of data. But, you know, Yahoo each day stores about half the text of the Library of Congress. And indeed, this isn't just for big firms. Now, computer companies like Dell will sell you a desktop computer with 1 terabyte of data. So these huge storage capabilities are something that everybody's got to start getting used to because they're coming to a computer near you.
You see, the Library of Congress is full of the summation of the learning of humankind up until now. It's a marvelous institution. It contains all human knowledge, whereas this terabytes in the Yahoo, it'll all be rubbish, won't it?
Well, not all rubbish. As a matter of fact, it's information on hospitalizations that we're just now starting to capture digitally. That is hardly rubbish. It's going to be the kind of information that will save thousands of lives. Up till now, our ancestors' deaths, from a statistical standpoint, have been in vain because most of them have gone to the hospital, died, and the information about their experience has just been lost to humanity. But now, for the first time, we're going to be able to exploit that in good ways to save people.
Okay, well, let's deal with some examples, and it'll help explain what you believe to be the power, basically, of number crunching. And I'd like to start with wine, if I could. French wine, delicious.
Sure.
French wine. And how do you work out whether it's delicious or not?
Well, you can start with a very simple statistical equation that controls for the weather, how much rain there was, what the average temperature was during the growing season. And a wonderful economist named Orly Ashenfelter has done this, and he's been able to predict the quality of Bordeaux before anyone has tasted them. Just looking at the chateau that they come from and the growing conditions turns out to be more accurate than traditional experts who try vainly after a few months to swish and spit and make a prediction of how it will mature.
Yeah, let's just explain the context, if you like. The traditional way, as you say, is for someone with a highly trained tongue or palate to taste the wine quite soon after it's produced, even though it may not come good for 20, 30 years, and to sort of work out their prediction as to whether or not it's going to be good. And you're saying that doesn't work as well as just looking at the weather, basically.
That's right. And you can actually look after both of them make their predictions. You can then compare who did a better job. And the statistician, Orley Ashenfelter, has done better year in and year out.
And just to explain that, you can measure the quality of the prediction by the price of the wine. That's what you're saying, isn't it? So, the good ones will be worth more in 10, 15 years, 20 years' time.
That's exactly right.
Okay, now then, there's another area which is rather more shocking, I think, for many people, which is predicting Supreme Court verdicts. Now, the Supreme Court in the States has 9 justices, the most senior, knowledgeable, respected, and so on, lawyers in the country. And they often have split decisions, 5-4, 6-3, that sort of thing. And you can use number crunching to work out what they're going to decide?
That's right. Some researchers, Pauline Kim, Ted Ruger, they ran a very natural experiment. They, in one corner, they pitted 83 lawyers trying to predict all the votes on all the Supreme Court cases for the 2002 term. And in the other corner, they had a crude statistical equation that algorithm that controlled for just 6 variables. And these 83 humans weren't just lawyers, but about half of them had clerked on the Supreme Court. They knew the ins and outs of it. And the big surprise is that the computer did a better job at predicting the votes of the justices. What we should take from this is a couple things. Is one, it's particularly when that the process becomes complicated that we make the mistake of thinking that experts do a better job. But when there are more than 10 or 20 underlying variables, that's actually when humans don't do a very good job predicting and you want to go to a statistical approach.
Yeah, but you said only 6, which surprises me. So I think we can just run through those perhaps, or at least some.
Sure.
Of them. What were the variables?
The variables were very crude. None of them, by the way, had to do with the specific issue in the case. They instead were, was the government a party to the litigation? Did the case come out of California? Everybody knows that the Supreme Court dislikes the California judges. The experts know this too, but when it comes to making predictions, they just don't put enough weight on that very simple variable. Paying attention to whether the lower court opinion is liberal or conservative, those are the kind of variables that putting the right weights on just those does a better job of letting the experts fall in love with their pet theories.
Surprising. That is surprising.
It is surprising unless you start looking at the literature and it turns out that they've done this kind of test of who makes the better prediction, humans or statistics, now hundreds of times. And this Supreme Court example is representative. Only about 6% of the time in these multiple studies do humans make statistically better predictions than the machine.
You see, the crazy implication of that is that you, without even looking at the merits of any case, you could just put it into a computer and get a verdict.
Well, and it's to say that you know that you can make a better prediction than human doesn't mean that it's going to be a perfectly accurate prediction. So I'm not saying that the computer only got it right, I think, about 70% of the time. So there still is important reasons to have the cases still decided.
Nonetheless, let me take you back to Freakonomics, which you'll be very familiar with, and for people who aren't, it's basically the idea that you can put together two rather unrelated, apparently, variables like the abortion rate and the crime rate and find there is a relationship. Now, that was quite sort of big research, and there's been a big book on it, but you're going further than that in trying to apply these kind of relationships, right?
That's exactly right. The results of Freakonomics are now being applied not just by me, but by decision makers in business, in government, in education, in medicine. They're impacting the way decisions are made.
Okay, examples. Now, airlines and working out which customers are going to come back.
Yeah, this is an example of happiness discrimination. So airlines have gotten into the business of predicting their customers' happiness. That sounds good. But then it turns out that they then turn around and they may discriminate against their happiest customers. So if you and I are on a flight that gets canceled and there's one seat on the next scheduled flight, it might be that you don't get it, even though you're a more profitable customer and have more frequent flyer miles. Why is this? Well, the airlines now are starting to predict which of us is more likely to jump ship to a different airline. And maybe they have data that says, I've been on two flights in the last 6 months that are canceled, and they think I'm at risk of defecting. Whereas, as a matter of fact, the fact that you have a lot of frequent flyer miles might lead them to believe that you're locked in and that they can treat you a little bit worse and get away with it. Under this new world of super crunching, happiness and loyalty aren't all that they once were cracked up to be.
And one aspect of that must be that the companies have huge amounts of data. I mean, they must be collecting an awful lot of information about anyone who uses their services.
Exactly. So they keep track, of course, of all the times that you have flown with them, and they keep track of what they euphemistically call transportation events. That's when you have a bad flight.
A non-transportation event.
Exactly, yes. Right. But they can also mash this data together with easily available information about who you are, what's your age, where you live, what your likely income is, and they can start making predictions about who's at risk to stop flying with them.
Does that mean that the big corporations are now employing statisticians?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're engaged in analytic competition to see who can crunch the numbers the best.
Do you ever feel, when you go into a store, that you don't want them to know?
Oh, yes. You know, if you think that they're going to use the information about you to take advantage of you to adjust the price or the quality of the service, we should have real concerns. But there are other places that don't worry at all. When Amazon uses my information to make predictions about what books I want to buy, I find that helpful. And movie rental services are helping me recommend movies that I'll actually enjoy renting. So,
and the weird thing about that is there's research that shows that the films recommended by the computer are enjoyed more by the customer than the ones they would just go to for themselves.
Exactly. Now, weird or to me, a consistent pattern that super crunching tends to make more accurate predictions.
It's all very well listed. But if you get the film you want, it's great. I agree. It's good. Yeah, but there's a sort of big brother, or is that just irrational? There's a big brother. I really don't want these people to know what movie I like. I want to know that.
I don't know if it's irrational or not. I think it's really important that people be given options to opt out of this. But to stay with movies, there is a firm called Epagogix, which has been quite successful at predicting how many tickets movies will sell. They code the script for about 200 variables and take into account the actors and directors and the promotional budget. And they can do a much better job than traditional studio heads of predicting how many tickets a movie will sell. And not only this is what will give you the willies, is that they will suggest script changes to increase the sales. Oh, if you add a buddy character for the protagonist, you might get an extra $5 million. Or if you shift the location from Chicago to New York, that might be an extra $2.5 million in sales. So
It's not art, is it?
I feel two ways about it. There have been people intervening, producers have been, studios have been intervening in the scripts for decades, but they've been doing it on bad information. It might be bad to interfere with art, but at least you want to do it on the basis of good information. And in some ways, look, I'm an economist, and this is giving the consumer what they want, and that's not all bad.
The thing is, you can't have a computer program do it because it will never be able to do the new thing, to make the breakthrough. The artist will be able to come up with a new idea, an iconoclastic concept that creates new territory, and all the other artists will then copy them in years to come. Computer's never going to do that.
I like that thought. It's one of the reasons I think that instead of just relying on crunching historical data, we should experiment on things that are outside of history. But even there, super crunching often will use a different technique, which is the randomized trial, that you can actually go out and test whether certain new things work or not.
You're listening to The Interview on the World Service of the BBC with Owen Bennett-Jones, and my guest today, Yale professor and number cruncher Ian Ayres. Well, just picking up on what you're saying there, it does seem, if we go down this route, that humans play less and less of a role, don't they?
Well, they play a different role. I want to be very clear. Humans are still essential to coming up with the hunches that drive this whole thing. It's because of Steve Levitt and John Donahue, their hunch about the relationship between abortion and crime that led to the central story of Freakonomics.
Tell us about direct instruction, because this is it's a similar idea. Tell us about that.
Well, so in education, we start seeing one of the big themes of super crunching, and this is that it often takes away discretion from individual workers. In education, there is a method called direct instruction, which is completely scripted. You walk into class, the teacher opens up his or her teaching manual and reads, "Good morning, class. Let's start learning to read the fast way." And the students start reading, and even your responses of praise or opprobrium are completely scripted. And it would seem that this would just be an impossible way to live as a teacher. But there have been massive studies that show that it teaches reading, math, several subjects, even higher order thinking more effectively. Students test better after being exposed to direct instruction than 16 other teaching methods.
So the point is the lesson is completely scripted in advance.
That's it. That's right. And to hear it is actually one of these lessons is actually a little bit chilling. But there's a tension that we just have to think about between, do we want something that is very effective at teaching reading? It's particularly effective for kids that are reading below grade. Or do we want something that is stimulating for workers? One of the lessons here is if you have any organization with 1,000 workers, you're going to do a better job if you routinize their tasks, script their tasks, and reduce their discretion so that they follow a statistically tested method.
What about the teachers, though? When they've got their script and they're coming into this direct instruction and they're saying everything according to the script, and then, you know, one of the children hits his or her neighbor, they have to go off script, I guess.
Oh, I guess, yeah, there are going to be some things that are not scripted, but it's the vast majority of the class, and indeed part of the class that's a little bit Orwellian itself, is that it calls upon the students to answer simultaneously. So that one of the core aspects of this is that each student is asked to respond about 8 times per minute, because they all respond in unison. And so the teacher can hear if somebody is out of step verbally in their answers. So it's troubling, but you know, the teachers initially resist, but after a few months, a couple things happen. One, some teachers like the fact that there's zero preparation, and secondly,
they don't have to prepare for their class because someone else has written the script.
You know, they just walk in and they read it. But secondly, some teachers they suddenly see that they start succeeding in teaching students things that they haven't been able to do for the last few years, and there is a joy about after the end of a semester seeing your students be able to read sentences that they haven't been able to, that past classes haven't been able to read.
Let me put this to you, that the teacher at his or her best will inspire, you know, and the doctor will not just use, I don't know, Google or whatever to get their diagnosis, but by the warmth and quality of their human relationship with the patient will heal. And that, you know, the statistical methods can't cope with that.
Let me say, I cried when I first saw To Sir With Love. We make movies about the inspirational teachers, but you can actually put this to the test of whether large groups of teachers that are given discretion to inspire, whether they do better than large groups of teachers that aren't given discretion.
Yes, I see. So there's one out of 100 will inspire, but the 99 will bore you to tears.
That's right. And your claims there are just empirically wrong. On average, if you have 1,000 teachers, it's better to destroy. And let me be provocative. It's better to shackle the five truly inspired than to let the 300 who think they're inspired go off and waste time.
Right. Okay. I'm gonna offer some limits, you know, some suggestions of where this goes wrong. Nicholas Taleb, I'm sure you read Nicholas Taleb? He was talking about black swans, unpredictable events. And really what he was saying was that even with all the number crunching in the world, you're not going to predict that certain things happen. And do you think, and that's happening more often? Yeah, there are more of these black swans. Do you think that's true?
Well, I certainly agree that you won't be able to predict everything. I don't know whether it's happening more often or not. My claim is that it allows you to predict things better than human intuition and experience. But there's going to be lots of things, one-off events about whether you should take a trip to the Mars or not, that it's going to be hard to crunch the ultimate information. And but if you want to make predictions, you can't run away from the fact that these statistical crunches are more accurate.
When you use the Mars example there, that's really saying there's not enough data because it's just happened so infrequently.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
But I mean, that's okay. I'll give you an example where there's, you know, probably more data, or historically anyway, than there has been on anything else, which is the markets, the financial markets. And
yes.
I think I'm right in saying that the best stockbroker in the world cannot predict when the price is going to go down.
Well, and not because there is a inherent randomness in new information hitting the market. And so while no one is good at predicting what the next day of returns are going to be, statistics does actually let you know an awful lot.
What about this? A lot of humans are not good at numbers.
Yes.
Is that a problem?
Yeah. You know, we really need to change our math instruction. So among college graduates, I would say about 2% actually get value out of calculus, but 100% of college graduates could get value out of statistics. I even think that statistics should be play a much larger role in intermediate, in high school education. And so it's not as intimidating as people often think, and it's incredibly useful and increasingly necessary in this world where we're awash with statistical information.
So do you not accept the idea that some people just can't do them? They're just not good at it?
Well, you know, there's a range of human capabilities, and sure, I would accept that there are some people that are going to be weaker in this than other things. There are people that are weaker in many different tasks, but we should put more energy into this. By the way, I practice what I preach. When my children were 7 and 9, I started teaching them statistics, and we've gone on, and we have co-authored, now my kids are 10 and 12, we've co-authored a statistical article. There's no reason why statistics has to be limited to rocket scientists. I was partly inspired. There's a great study that MIT and Chicago economists did. They sent out resumes in response to want ads in the newspaper, and the resumes were identical, except some had names that were African-American-sounding names and some were Caucasian-sounding names. And they just flipped coins. They random. They sent some of these resumes to different employers. And at the end of the day, with a randomized study, you just have to pay attention to the difference in averages. They found that the African-American resumes were, on average, less likely to be called back than the Caucasian names. And part of my response to this article is there's no reason why you or I couldn't have done this study when we were in high school. It's so simple. And so there's a world of randomized tests that high schoolers could do with the help of senior colleagues. I don't make the claim that high schoolers can come up with the interesting hypotheses to test, but they certainly, once somebody gives them the hypothesis, it's pretty easy to run a randomized study.
How much have governments actually used this kind of technique to make policy decisions?
It's happening more and more. And again, these randomized studies are so transparent, the results, that they have a great power with policymakers. In Mexico, there is a randomized study of a project called Progresa, which is giving poor mothers some extra food if their kids went to a doctor regularly, or extra money if their kids went to school at least 85% of the time. They wanted to see whether this contingent food and money, whether it had a positive impact. And they did a very powerful randomized study. They took 500 villages, and half of them they offered this PROGRESA subsidy to, and half they didn't. And after 2.5 years, they just looked at the difference in the averages. And the families that were given the food supplements were much healthier. They had about 12% less serious disease. This is just a huge public health win. Mexico has taken this program nationwide, and it's now helping millions of families in Mexico. And there are 30 other countries around the world that are now emulating the PROGRESA system.
Well, you're passionate about this, aren't you?
I am. And
for a reason, and the reason is you think it can help.
It can. I mean, there are cautionary tales for us. It may hurt us at times as consumers, as workers. It may take away our discretion in ways that are scary to us, but it provides better predictions. In fact, I used a randomized trial to come up with the very title of this book. I went into this project just loving the title, The End of Intuition, but I tried to apply my thesis to myself. On Google, I ran a randomized test to see whether Super Crunchers did better than The End of Intuition, and it did. It got 63% higher click-through rate. So much for my intuition.
Ian Ayres, thank you very much for talking to us on the interview.
A pleasure.